Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Steve Silver Show on Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, indeed, it is the return of the Steve Silver Show, back from its winter hiatus. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm glad everybody is taking the time to tune into this afternoon show, and what a show we have lined up for you today. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Bo Reed, letstalkrangers.com, of course, is always in the house, always along for the ride. Bo, Happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year.
That's all you got? That's it? Just Happy New Year?
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to maybe having a season in baseball where my entire team doesn't hit the DL. Looking forward to that.
That was a dynamite dropping by you. Yeah, it was just, you know, Happy New Year. No big deal. You know, was the holidays good for you? I mean, I know you went back to it's the home state of Texas. Got a little home cooking over the holidays. How did that go?
Well, I came back 10 pounds heavier.
Fantastic.
That's what you do when you go home. But it was interesting because obviously, it's been cold in Baltimore. It's cold in Baltimore. It's the winter.
Sure.
So I when I go home to Texas, especially in the winter, you know, I'm expecting a break from the Baltimore weather. I get to Texas. It's actually colder in Texas than it is in Baltimore the entire time I'm there. So there's that.
Wow. Fantastic. Well, as you know, as per usual, Bo, we do indeed have ourselves a fantastic show lined up. Not only do we have college football's national championship on pace, but we also have NFL's championship weekend that we're going to break down, as well as Major League Baseball's off seasons as we get into January, coming into February, pitchers and catchers report. There's still possibly two big fish still left out there, Max Scherzer, James Shields. We'll get into that. We're also going to introduce a rapid-fire question segment that I like to call Steve's rapid-fire question segment, so there's that. We, of course, are going to span the globe and get some get some headlines going for everybody out there. But we also have Chris Mitchell, who's going to be stopping by. Of course, Chris Mitchell is our patented roto expert. It's always good to have a roto expert for all those fantasy guys out there. I'm not necessarily a fantasy guy per se, but we'll have Chris Mitchell on, not necessarily to talk a little bit about fantasy, but we're just gonna have him on because, well, you know, Chris is just a good guy. So, Bo, all that said and done, I got to be honest with you, man. I'm fired up. I am fired up because, well, we've been off for about a good 4 weeks. You know, we have the holidays, and of course, I had a very good holiday, and it wouldn't be, I would be remiss if I didn't say that this has been quite an interesting football season, and we're going to kick today's spanning the globe off in a place that I like to call Cleveland. So first and foremost, let's get a little music attached to spanning the globe, and we'll start right there in Cleveland.
Spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of sport, the thrill of victory, and the agony of defeat.
Speaking of defeat, Bo, the Cleveland Browns should feel defeated because, again, I can't get over the fact that owner Randy Lerner has completely taken this franchise, and I have no idea what he's doing with this franchise. This is, next to the Washington Redskins, this is probably one of the most dysfunctional franchises from top all the way to bottom.
Yep.
And a couple days ago, the news came out that Kyle Shanahan, has resigned. He pretty much got the hell out of town. And quarterback coach Dowell Loggins has been fired. I would be remiss if I couldn't say, well, you know what? Quite honestly, it's not necessarily their fault, considering that the owner himself really wanted Johnny Manziel, while, quarterback coach Dowell Loggins said, listen, we should just stick with Hoyer. Kyle Shanahan didn't come into this situation to mess with a dude like Johnny Manziel. He didn't even want Johnny Manziel. And, of course, ownership wanted Manziel.
Sure.
And we saw exactly what happened. Cleveland, Kyle Shanahan says, you know what, vamoose. Dowell Loggins says, you know what, well, whatever, I'm fired. And this whole mess now, it's sad, isn't it, Bo? It has to be sad if you're a Cleveland Browns fan. And every
sure.
single year, this is like a tradition. It's either the coach goes, a coordinator goes, and now obviously the quarterback coach comes. And if I don't even blame Kyle Shanahan for not wanting to work with Johnny Manziel. It's a dude that he didn't want, and now he doesn't have to work with him.
I can't blame him at all. In fact, I'm a little surprised that he hasn't jumped ship sooner than this. I mean, come on. He doesn't want the guy, so ownership shoves the guy down his throat. Now you have to deal with Manziel and all of his drama.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's. I wish we could talk about just the on-field stuff, but the thing is with Cleveland, it's so bad that it's even horrible off the field. It's a running soap opera in Cleveland.
To me, Bo, this sounds like a little bit of Jim Irsay, a little bit of Robert Kraft, a little bit of Jerry Jones, a lot of Jerry Jones. To me, it seems that this ownership group really wants to be in the forefront of what, of everything. They don't necessarily want to give the stage to their football people.
Yeah.
What they want to do is they want to take all the headlines. They want to make it all about them.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, Jimmy Haslam. Lerner used to be the old guy. Jimmy Haslam. He seems to be the type of guy that really just wants the headlines, that doesn't want to acquiesce to their football operations. And as a result, we saw the big show, Mike Holmgren,
mm-hmm.
be relieved of his duty. And now all of a sudden we have this, and the football people didn't want Johnny Manziel. They said, listen, we have a dude in Brian Hoyer. We should put our full confidence behind Brian Hoyer. Even if it doesn't work out the way that we, you know, even if it doesn't net us a playoff, it's going to net us stability, and that's something that they haven't had. And, of course, Haslam says, you know what? He's throwing up his little dollar signs like Johnny Manziel and says, you know what? Big show here. I'm the guy. This is
yeah.
me. And you know what? This is part Jim Irsay. This is part Robert Kraft. This is part Jerry Jones. This is a guy that wants to be known as one of those guys. It's even Mark Cuban to an extent. This is
yeah.
a guy that wants to be in the spotlight. So you know what? This is exactly what you get. This is exactly what you want. This is exactly what you get. And you know what? I gotta be. You know me, Bo. I like uh-huh. Cleveland. I like the Cleveland Browns. I do, and I feel bad for the. I feel bad for the organization, for the people that work there. I feel bad for the players, and of course, I feel bad for the Cleveland fans, for the Cleveland fan base.
Well, I mean, it is a fan base that's used to this when they're sports teams. I mean, it's not exactly the sports capital of the world. But here's the question: have the Browns mm-hmm. officially passed the Raiders as the laughingstock of football?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question.
Have the Cleveland Browns passed the Raiders? I would probably think not yet, because the Raiders are pretty bad. I mean, the Raiders can't seem – like, put it this way. The Raiders interviewed Eric Mangini. You know what I mean? Like, that was a name that I don't think either of us saw coming from the – you know, from that perspective. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, that it's good that they're just – they're canvassing – but do you believe that the Raiders, even with a new head coach, that vision is going to change? They're going to be completely useless.
Yeah.
At least with the Cleveland Browns, they've had some successful drafts. They're not getting their drafts wrong per se. At least this team was competitive for at least three quarters of the season before finally bowing out.
Yeah.
The Raiders are not at all remotely competitive at all.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they did close the season well.
Yeah.
The Raiders did close the season well, but I think that, you know, you look at the Browns, and most of their problems revolve around development of their players. Because you're right. I mean, they do have good drafts. They take good guys in the draft, but it doesn't translate to the NFL level, especially at the quarterback position. And it makes you wonder, is it because they're picking the wrong quarterbacks? I don't think so. I think that if they held on to Colt McCoy, they wouldn't have had to draft Brandon Whedon. They wouldn't have had to draft Johnny Manziel. Colt McCoy, if they'd given him a chance, probably could have developed. Is he going to be a star? No, but I mean, come on. There's only a handful of star quarterbacks in the NFL as it is. And that seems to be what the Browns are wanting. They want that.
Well,
guy.
Yeah.
They want that guy.
Do you blame them, though? Do you blame them?
I mean, this is
a star-driven league, especially at the quarterback position. And if you don't have it, like, I'll give you a good example. Like, I don't consider Tony Romo a star. Like, I really don't. But he's been there for ages, and he's finally starting to do it. The Seahawks found a diamond in the rough, and all of a sudden, he's a star. The San Francisco 49ers thought they had a star. It's important that you have that at your quarterback position, which is probably the need to facilitate It's the need to justify the picking of a Johnny Manziel.
Okay,
I can understand why they did it. So from that end, I get it. But what's kind of funny about this is when it's all said and done, because there is so much dysfunction, I'm kind of with you in the sense where I don't know if that's going to develop outright. I don't know if he's going to develop outright. This to me seems like it's going to be set up for failure for this one thing. If he was in a system like Mike McCarthy in Green Bay or with Bill Belichick in New England, where they have Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers in front of them, and he can literally just develop, I would probably think that if he went to Cleveland like 3 years later, he'd probably be more successful than right now because he had time to develop. The problem with being in Cleveland and the problem with being in that spotlight in Cleveland and playing for an owner that really is going to acquiesce to his player and give the player the ability to not necessarily tune into his coaching staff, it just seems like you're playing with dynamite with Johnny Manziel at that point. Does that make sense?
Perfect sense. They were playing with dynamite the second they drafted him. But I think what it boils down to is they never give a quarterback a chance to develop. Mm-hmm. And that's why they've gone through, 25 since Kosar? I mean, you know, they just do not allow their quarterbacks the time they need to develop. I mean, this isn't like it was 20 years ago, Steve, where quarterbacks come out of college because they're playing pro system.
It's a win-now league. It's a what-have-you-done-for-me-lately type of thing. So the need to justify that number one pick, you have to – if you're a number one pick and you're a quarterback, you will play. And if you're going to be playing on the field, you have to win. And even if you lose, you have to show the ability that you can actually hang in this league. And the two starts or the one and a half starts that Johnny Manziel had, he didn't look like he could even hang in this league. He looked pretty, pretty bad. Headline number two, Bo, goes to the baseball world. And, of course, very good candidates that went into the Baseball Hall of Fame this year. John Schmoltz, Pedro Martinez, Randy Johnson, all first ballot, no doubt about it. Craig Biggio got in. Very good pick. But it wasn't just the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Fame induction of the four players. It came from Randy Johnson, who was basically using that platform to shine a light on the designated hitter position, most notably his ex-teammate, personally who I believe is the greatest right-handed baseball player, greatest right-handed hitter that I've ever seen in my lifetime, Edgar Martinez. Basically acquiescing to his platform to say, hey, listen, this is a dude that belongs in the Hall of Fame, and rightfully so, he does. Bo, I think it's kind of funny that the Baseball Writers Association of America still looks down on the designated hitter, considering it's been a position since 1972. Now, granted, the DH position has basically been filled by guys, you know, at the tailor in their position. But then again, there are Hall of Famers that have used long-standing periods at the DH to basically catapult them into the Hall of Fame. Two noteworthy candidates, Paul Molitor, got in while playing 8 years as the DH at the end of his career. And, of course, last year, I believe, the big hurt, Frank Thomas, who, by the way, played 11 years as a DH, played more than half of his decade as the DH. He gets in. And I have a feeling that there's a very good possibility that this will not play out for Edgar Martinez until a dude like David Ortiz gets in, and which is kind of funny if you think about this, considering that there's only 8 players in Major League history that have more than 200 home runs, more than 1,000, I believe, more than 1,000 RBIs, over 300 doubles. And number 8 on that list is Edgar Martinez. The 7 names, I believe, were Stan Musial, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig. I mean,
sure.
Guys like that that are already in the Hall of Fame, and then you got a guy like Edgar Martinez who is out, and the only reason why he's not in is because obviously he was a designated hitter. I would probably think that it's also because, A, he played in Seattle, and he only had about, like, what, four opportunities in the postseason, had very good postseasons, but the difference between him and a dude like David Ortiz is the fact, well, Ortiz, you know, has the World Series experience, has the rings, and right. So you would probably assume that the Baseball Writers Association, before they elect a dude like Edgar Martinez, which is a shame, would elect David Ortiz beforehand, you know, I guess you can say to validate the DH position. To me, it seems a little ridiculous. Now, I'm trying to be as non-biased as possible because obviously I live in Seattle and I've seen a
short
career from start to finish. But what I will say is Edgar Martinez more than deserves to be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Randy Johnson didn't need to have that platform to say it. I think everybody understands it. And it's a shame that the Baseball Writers Association of America is looking at the DH position as not a real position. I mean,
yeah.
My calculation for the Hall of Fame is, did you dominate your position for over a 10-year period? Did the writers acknowledge it? Did your peers acknowledge it? And you know what? Did the fans acknowledge it? And everybody from that entire circle basically say that Edgar Martinez was probably the most feared hitter of that decade, of that generation. You ask any of the top pitchers who is the one guy that they didn't want to face, and of course it's Edgar Martinez, and he's got the numbers to prove it. It's an absolute shame, Bo.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. I think you hit on the head. The writers don't recognize the DH as a position, and that's the problem. And you know, it's going to come to a head when Ortiz is up, but the problem is I don't know if Edgar's going to be able to stay on the ballot
right.
when David Ortiz comes around. You know, it is a shame. You're talking about one of the great hitters of a generation and played it in a generation. I mean, he played it in the live ball era. And was still like he was still at the top of everybody,
right?
Because he spent the entire career as a DH shouldn't matter,
mind you. This is also the same Baseball Writers Association that didn't give enough votes for Carlos Delgado to even stay on the ballot. And by the way, Carlos Delgado quietly had 10 straight seasons of 30 plus home runs. He should at least stay on the ballot. Hey, but Bo, before you respond quickly, Chris Mitchell is on the line.
Nice.
Chris Mitchell, our good friends from RotoExpert.com. Chris, I'm glad that you came in right at this level because we are talking about the Hall of Fame ballots, specifically the candidacy of one Edgar Martinez. And I don't know if you were there for the entire conversation, though, but it seems to me that before the baseball writers will ever elect a DH, they're going to wait until David Ortiz's career is finished before they decide to make a move on a DH. I would probably assume that he would be the first to get in, and then maybe a guy like Edgar Martinez might come up with the Veterans Committee. But to me, it's a shame, considering there's only 8 players in Major League Baseball history that have at least 250 home runs, 250, 1,000 RBIs, 300 double, or 500 double, some crazy number like that. And all 7 of those guys are in the Hall of Fame, most notably Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Stan Musial, the usual suspects, and number 8 on that list is Edgar Martinez. And it's a shame to me that, number one, that the DH is being treated like that, considering guys like Paul Molitor and guys like Frank Thomas are in that spent substantial time at the DH. And number 2, you know, they're holding his postseason track record against him because obviously he was a Seattle Mariner who's only played 4 times in the playoffs. Your thoughts on the candidacy of Edgar Martinez?
Again, good to be talking some baseball with you. I love talking baseball with you guys. I actually think if you look at the governing body and how it's going more kind of these new sabermetric measures and looking at those kinds of numbers, I wonder if maybe they're dreading when David Ortiz gets there because there's going to be so much popular pressure to get Ortiz in that they'll look at Edgar and they'll look at Big Poppy's numbers and say, how do we vote for Poppy who everybody assumes we want to put in? And yet we don't put in Edgar, because really, Edgar is a better hitter than David Ortiz. David has that slim connection to steroids, and he denies it, and the evidence against him isn't strong, but there's at least a whiff there of steroids, and some writers, all you need is a whiff. You don't need any real evidence. I remember there was some writer that admitted this time that he heard someone say that they heard that someone else said that Piazza used, and he didn't vote for him because of that. And David Ortiz has a little bit more of a closer connection to steroids even to that, though I think a lot of people do think Piazza used. But getting back to it, I mean, David Ortiz is going to be a popular name, and the one thing that Ortiz has that Edgar doesn't is he has those clutch moments. David Ortiz is seen as Mr. Clutch. He had these great moments in postseason that made him a lovable guy, and everyone seems to love him. He's like the big, he's sort of like a big panda, only the first one. So I don't know what these guys are going to say when a very lovable guy who wasn't as good a hitter as Edgar either gets in or there's a really strong push to get him in. I almost think they're going to really dread when Ortiz comes up into it. Now, this is, what, probably 10 years from now. So maybe Edgar's off the mark. Maybe Edgar might be off the ballot by then, and they won't have to care other than as an anecdotal complaint. Say, well, how do you put David Ortiz in when you didn't put Edgar in? What I do find interesting about this debate, and if you do believe that defense is an important part of the game, and people who love the National League style, I think they have to say that. I mean, how do you like having the pitcher hit unless you really do think that defense is important? A lot of these players, especially these days with the sabermetrics involved, you look at a lot of these players, and defense is actually a net negative. When you factor in WAR, a lot of players are overvalued because they overvalue defense. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of the coin, a lot of players, there are negatives. It actually hurts their stats. So there are people arguing, for example, that Jeff Kent deserves to be in the Hall of Fame and that they can't believe he's not in. Well, Jeff Kent actually has to overcome the fact that he was seen as a negative defensive player, and yet there are still people who believe in sabermetrics that believe Jeff Kent can be in. So if you've got a David Ortiz or an Edgar who don't have any negatives, they don't have any positives, obviously, because they didn't play at all, but you've actually got Jeff Kent as a negative defensive player who has to overcome his defense versus an Edgar who actually played adequate defense from what I've heard. If you listen to, like, a Jaffe who was an MLB Network and some of those Hall of Fame kind of experts, they actually give him a little bit of credit for playing some defense. He didn't do a lot of it, but he played some. But how do you vote for Jeff Kent, who was a negative defensively, versus an Ortiz or an Edgar who were just neutral because they didn't play at all?
Right, and you know, for those that do remember, Edgar for basically his first 2.5 full seasons in the major league, and he didn't really get his start until the age 27-28 season, Bo. So he was a late starter, and then it ended up playing into his 40s. But a lot of people forget that he was a third baseman for like 2.5 seasons to start his career, and before he radically tore his hamstring off the bone, and that's pretty much when Mariner management said, "Listen, dude, you're just going to be the DH. You can hit. Your value is with your bat, anyways. You know, we can find somebody to play third base," and that's exactly what happened. But getting back to Chris's point, Bo, a lot of people forget that he was the reason why the Mariners. He single-handedly destroyed the Yankees in 95 in that divisional series. Yep. He was the only reason what kept the Mariners in the 97 LDS against Baltimore, which they eventually lost 3-1. And again, he was basically the main reason why the Mariners beat the Indians in the first round of the 2001 playoffs after winning 116 games, and the Indians took him to 5, and it was Edgar Martinez that came up clutch in that series as well, too. So, I completely understand what Chris was saying, that David Ortiz – It's fresh in our minds because he has the rings. That's the difference. He's got the rings, and the rings ultimately are what people remember. But listen, Edgar Martinez, Bo, single-handedly is the greatest right-handed hitter I think I've ever seen. Right-handed or left-handed, he's the greatest pure hitter that I've ever seen. And I didn't even see Ted Williams was well before our time, and he was literally considered next to Ty Cobb or even Pete Rose as single-handedly the greatest purest hitters that this game has to offer. And Edgar Martinez, in my lifetime, he's right up there with those two.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yes.
I would absolutely agree with that.
From a pure hitting standpoint, I'm not talking power, and I'm not talking some of these other things, but just from a pure contact standpoint and the ability to finish his career with an average over 350, who does that? Who does?
A Hall of Famer does.
A Hall of Famer does it.
For the life of me, I will never understand why Edgar Martinez is not in already. It shouldn't be David Ortiz paving the way for Edgar Martinez. It should be the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not going to be that way until these writers start to recognize that a designated hitter position is, in fact, a position.
It took the Baseball Writers Association a very long time to even recognize the closer's role. But finally, they Eckersley, Gooseguss, and some of these other guys, Sutter, got in. So, it's going to take some time. But what's unfortunately is they shrunk the years. It used to be 15 years that they would stay on the ballot. Now it's only 10. So, in essence, if they're not going to make a move on the DH, DH position, it very well could be that the only way Edgar could possibly get in is through the Veterans Committee after he gets off the ballot,
right.
Which would be an absolute friggin' shame. But headline number three, Bo and Chris, comes from the world of college football. And again, we were on the break, so we didn't necessarily have the ability to talk about it. So now we're going to use this platform to talk about it. The University of Michigan made a very big, very good hire, bringing in a fellow quarterback, fellow alum by the name of Jim Harbaugh. I don't know if you guys heard about this guy, but apparently he was the head coach of the San Francisco 49ers, and apparently he did well in San Francisco. Three straight NFC championships, a Super Bowl appearance before this year, before the wheels kind of came off a little bit. It seems to be his MO, guys. I mean, Jim Harbaugh is a guy who was at Stanford, had a very good success. Right around the four-year mark, things kind of ran a little dry. He ends up exiting, going to San Francisco, and again, 4 years. And now he's at the University of Michigan, where, quite frankly, he's at a place where he's not the type of guy that really likes the boosters, doesn't really like the Alumni Association, but then again, it is the alma mater. I got to be honest with you. I love the hire. He's going to be one of those type of guys that will come in and demand excellence from his players. And we saw exactly what type of a crap sandwich Michigan has become under the predecessors there. This is going to be very good. Now, to me, this is all about not what's going to happen per se on the field this year. It's going to be about what happens on the recruiting trail, because again, Urban Meyer has just that entire Great Lakes region just on lockstep. The only thing that they have going for them in the state of Michigan is the fact, well, everybody's a Wolverine fan, not a Buckeye fan. So with inside the confines of the state of Michigan, this will be very good. But as you know, the key to the success is going to be how they're going to be able to out-recruit Urban Meyer at Ohio State. I think he's going to be a very good hire. This is a very good hire for not just the University of Michigan guys, but also for the Big Ten and also college football for as a whole, to get a name like Jim Harbaugh, a very big name back in the coaching ranks of college football. Bo, this is a huge hire.
Oh, it's definitely huge. I mean, if you look at what's going on in Michigan really over the last few years, they haven't gone after that name guy. You know, they go after guys that have had some success at lower-level colleges and put them in. Those guys are not going to out-recruit Urban Meyer. But Jim Harbaugh has a chance because he's in name.
I don't think so. I like Urban Meyer, okay? Urban Meyer is college coaching legend. You know what I mean? That he's one of those type of dudes where you have guys like Saban, then you have you have Saban and Meyer, and then you have LSU, Les Miles. You have those type of guys, and then you have the second tier very good coaches, which I believe Jim Harbaugh is in. Urban Meyer is just a fantastic dude. Chris, I look at this and I look at this as being a very good breath of fresh air into the Michigan program, because again, this was a program that has seen its fan base diminish. Of all places in Ann Arbor, where even like you can tolerate a bad season, but when you have a program that completely had the wheels completely come off, once you start losing fan bases, it's going to be very hard to get that back. Jim Harbaugh, instantly, the credibility that he brings to the program, Chris, does that. Again, love the hire.
Yeah, in a place like Michigan, I don't think they could actually fail for quite some time, and then they make this kind of hire, and it gets them right back to where they were when they were an elite program. I'm in the Boston area, and Boston College had a few years where we were pretty competitive. We had some national runs here. We beat Notre Dame a couple times, and that was in the Tom Coughlin days. And we became sort of a national program in football for a very short period of time. But then Tom Coughlin left. We started losing. And other than an isolated year or two here or there, Boston College, the program is no longer on the map. So we don't have a tradition of it up here in Boston College. But Michigan, I think you can fail there for long periods of time, but they want a great program in Michigan. So once you send a Harbaugh there, as much as maybe they took a 5 or 6 year period off, they could take 10, even 15 years off. And I think if they land a splash like they just did, the program's right back to what they used to be, and the fan base is there. So I think it's just ingrained in that area. Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, those specific really good programs in those areas. This hire alone solves all the problems that they might have had over the last 5 or 10 years. So just the name alone, to me, brings that program back to prominence. And it's good. It's very good for college football when Michigan is that. I mean, these days, how many teams play competitive games anymore? It seems like the major programs play, what, one or two competitive games every year? the Big Ten is probably the most competitive conference going. And I used to hate them. I used to hate the Big Ten and how they didn't schedule very many good teams out of conference. But in conference now, they're pretty competitive. I think Harbaugh will do fine. The cachet that Bo mentioned, I think Harbaugh brings it to him. He may not be as great of a recruiter as Urban Meyer, because there's some swagger to it. Some guys are just great salesmen. Pete Carroll, as you know very well, I think he's a great salesman.
Right.
More than a great coach. When he was in New England, Pete Carroll was not a good coach. But obviously, USC, he was a fantastic recruiter. I don't know how good of a recruiter Harbaugh is in comparison to an Urban Meyer, but the swagger and the cachet that his name brings, his assistants just throw out the name and say, you want to go to the pros? Harbaugh's going to get you there. And they're going to do a lot better in recruiting. Now, can they get the elite guys, those top five that go to the Floridas or go to the Texases or the Florida States or the USCs, can they get those guys? That might take some skill in recruiting, but he's going to get much better players up and down that roster at the very least. So Michigan's going to be much better off.
Well, what's interesting about this, when Harbaugh was at Stanford, he put together some very good recruiting classes with the academic standards that Stanford holds, where traditionally they say that it's very hard to recruit at places like that. He did a pretty decent job there. What I will say is you hit it right on the head. I think because of his time at San Francisco, I think he's going to be able to have that type of cachet where he can go into a house of one of those top 10 recruits, Bo, and just say, hey, let's flash those championship rings and basically say, hey, listen, man, I know exactly what it takes not only to get to the pros but also how to develop in the pros. If you want to be in the pros, I'm your guy. And you know what? That's going to carry a lot of weight because, again, This is a now an age of college football where recruits are swayed by big time programs that are always on TV, programs that are always in the national spotlight, because the more attention that program gets, the more attention that player is going to get, which means you're going to be in front of the eyes of recruiters and also the ESPNs of the world, the Mel Kuypers of the world. So yeah, it's that important. So there's going to be that type of cachet. I would just assume from the standpoint of what Chris was talking about, I beg to differ, because we saw Michigan. What happened when Rich Rodriguez couldn't do what he did at West Virginia that he's promised that he was going to do at Michigan, and what happened? The fan base kind of turned on him, and as a result, we saw dwindling attendance. And especially Brady Hoke had an 11-win season at one point, at his tenure at Michigan, and all of a sudden you saw exactly how quick the wheels fell off. And then again, the fans revolted against Hoke, and guess what happened? They stopped showing up. And once that happens, what's kind of funny is maybe 15 years ago, Chris, Bo, they were able to withstand a string of four straight losing seasons. But now in a day and age where now we have this college football playoff, you can have one bad season, but you sure as hell can't have two. And you know what? Jim Harbaugh has brought in to make sure that never happens, Bo.
Yeah.
It never happens.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
They're giving him $48 million to make sure that does not happen.
Well, and you're also looking at a track record of coaches from the NFL going to a college program like in Michigan and turning it around very quickly and being very successful.
Yeah.
Maybe it's when it comes to recruiting, he's more like, I assume, is going to run a pro offense at Michigan. That's a big deal for a player to hear, because that's exactly what gets them where they want to be, which is playing on Sundays.
Yes. Well, guys, that's going to take care of our headlines for tonight. Of course, spanning the globe is always brought to you in part by FanDuel.com. Of course, the Internet's only number one-week fantasy gaming site. Check them out at FanDuel.com. There you go. Let's go ahead and jump into our featured topic. And, of course, it is championship weekend in the NFL. Four games that are slated. Chris, since you're joining us tonight, we'll start off in the AFC and talk about your New England Tom Brady's as they take on the Baltimore Ravens. And what's kind of funny about this seems to be a matchup to me where a lot of people just expect Baltimore to be able to go in and compete. I don't look at this New England team, Chris, as a team that we saw the last couple rounds, the last two playoff rounds. To me, this is a team that actually is playing a lot better defense. They seem to have gotten back to what made them a dynasty back in the early 2000s. Now, granted, Tom Brady doesn't necessarily have the weapons, but what he does have is a very decent running game that is going to allow him to utilize his receiver weapons. And because of it, New England seems like a very good team right now. They seem like a very deadly team. And by the way, they're also 9-2 in first round playoff games. So there's a lot of success with the first playoff game. I like Baltimore. I really do. But I got to be honest with you. I just don't see a scenario this time around where Baltimore is going to be able to go into Foxborough and beat the Patriots. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, when I look at the NFL, I really do think parity has taken over. I don't see very many dominant teams. Seattle, the way your defense is playing, it sure implies that just with their defense they can dominate people. But you look across the entire AFC, no one team, I think, is great. So you come in and you look and you say, well, if the Patriots had to face the Steelers, or would you rather face the Steelers or the Ravens or the Bengals or whoever? No one team scares you, and I think the Patriots are better than anyone that they could have faced in this matchup. And the fact that they get the Ravens, the only thing that scares people up here, nobody seems to believe the Ravens are better. The Patriots' defense is much better than it has been in the past, which is going to be important because before our defense was a little bit soft. But the Ravens are just a mediocre team. If they came in like a Seattle and could dominate us on defense and really just take away what Tom Brady and the offense can do, then I could see how we could lose purely on talent on the field. But I don't think the Ravens' defense is like that. They're 23rd against the pass as far as yards allowed this season. And so you just don't run the ball. It's tough to run against the Ravens, but you can pass against them. So it's not like the Ravens of the past where they essentially won with defense. And so on the field, purely on talent, the Patriots absolutely should win this game. The one problem and the one thing that everyone's nervous about up here in New England is that the Ravens have a good track record of either giving us close games or beating us or outright pounding us. I forget which year it was, but in one of the first games, one of the only Patriots losses in their first round of any playoff run, the Ravens came in there and beat us like 41-7, and the game was over in the first 6 minutes. So people remember that. They remember the fact that the Ravens missed a field goal that should have had them beat us 2 years in a row. So people know that the Ravens seem to fight us tough and give us tough games. So people are afraid of that. But on the field, if you took away that, if you're from Iowa and don't realize how tough it's been for the Patriots to play the Ravens, on the field, player to player, the Patriots should win this game relatively easily. And with Revis covering the little offense they have down the field for the Ravens, really, the Patriots should win this pretty comfortably. But again, the Ravens are tough. They play physical, and they do give the Patriots a tough time. So I'm nervous, but I'm Boston people. We all assume the worst. Living with the Red Sox all these years, we assume the worst. And so that's what people are really afraid of here.
If you're from Iowa, Bo, I think the last thing that's on your collective plate is Baltimore, New England. But I will say this. New England is a 7-point favorite at home. That's the Vegas consensus on this game. And I'm under the impression, Bo, that not only is New England going to cover, but this possibly could be a little bit better than 7. Now, listen, I understand what Baltimore did against Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh has been playing very well vertically. Baltimore went in there and literally just that secondary and the way that they were and the way that they were getting at Ben Roethlisberger was a thing of beauty. I'll give it to them. But I got to be honest with you. New England's offensive line has been playing very, very, very well. They've been very consistent.
Right.
LeGarrette Blount, ever since he's come back, has given Tom Brady just that little extra dynamic that seemed to have been missing. I really enjoy the way that this New England offense is working. Of course, New England secondary is playing incredibly well right now. That whole defense has been playing pretty well. I think we're going to make this a clean sweep, correct? You got New England win this game?
This is
quintessential Bo Reed. This is exactly it. He was like, yeah. Well, oh, what? You're talking to me? Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. This makes for great radio. I gotta
No, yeah, you know, I've got
this is perfect, man. This is perfect. Of course I'm talking to you, Bo. Come on, buddy.
No, of course I'm taking New England in this one. You know, I mean, I understand, you know, the history with the Ravens going to, especially in Foxborough. I understand that. This isn't that Ravens team. It's just not.
It's not that.
And, you know, I mean, and, you know, having watched the Ravens a little bit more this year than I normally do because of where I live, it's just not a team that can go to Foxborough and beat Tom Brady right now.
You're right about that. I mean, no Ray Rice. You don't have Ed Reed. You don't have Ray Lewis. This isn't what it was 2 years ago. But then again, I mean, Joe Flacco can win some ball games. He can also win ball games on the road. So I'm not going to sit here and say that they don't have a chance. I've learned long ago, and I know Chris, you understand this. You understand this very well. never bet against Tom Brady because, Chan, more often times than not, you will lose. And I am not going to go against Tom Brady in this matchup because, well, quite frankly, there's no reason to bet against Tom Brady in this matchup. So, yeah, there's that. The other game on the docket in the AFC is Indianapolis traveling to Denver to take on Peyton Manning. So it's Peyton Manning's old team versus his new team. To me, this seems like a bad matchup for the Indianapolis Colts. To me, this is literally just Andrew Luck on an island. I don't like this matchup. I mean, Andrew Luck is really going to have to pass, in my estimation, for 400 yards in this game to even really have a chance in this ball game. This is really, personally, I think this is a bad matchup for the Indianapolis Colts. I mean, I would really love to see Andrew Luck be in a good position where he can win this playoff game. But I think being in Denver, it's a pretty good home field advantage for the Broncos. And really, I mean, yeah, I understand that Denver really kind of was inconsistent at best heading into the playoffs because, I mean, you know, they got away from the timing passing route. They were really relying a lot on their running game, which is good to see, you know, them get a running game going. But really, the bread and butter is Peyton Manning and his ability, you know, to use those timing routes as a running game and get everybody mixed in. Even though that, you know, the piece is really, you know, it's kind of like a hodgepodge right now for Peyton Manning, I still believe that Denver is going to win this game, Bo. I would really like to see Andrew Luck get a victory in this game. I really like to see him go on the road and actually get a playoff victory. I think it's going to be it would go a long ways towards his reputation as being an elite quarterback. You're going to need these type of playoff wins. I just don't think it's coming this year.
No, I don't think it's coming this year. You know, it's not a good matchup. You just highlighted it beautifully. The Broncos really were inconsistent going into the playoffs, but hey, come on, they had that week off. Work on a lot of things, get some guys, maybe some bumps and bruises, a little healthier. This is Peyton Manning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and Andrew Luck may eventually get to that level, but this is still Peyton Manning. And just like you don't bet against Tom Brady, you don't bet against Peyton Manning, especially when he's got a team around him like he does right now. The Colts, I think, are going to put up a fight, but they're going to have to win a shootout. Can they do that? And this is also, you know, we look at what happened to Denver in the Super Bowl, and what they've done in the offseason, what they did in the draft to fix that defense that just got shredded on the big stage. Now it's time to see what they got. And if that defense is going to be capable enough to get them over the hump and actually get them the Lombardi this time instead of their offense just getting up to the big game.
Mm-hmm. Chris, number one, what have we heard about Julius Thomas and his availability for this upcoming playoff game? And if so, if that's the case and Peyton Manning has a guy that basically has a security blanket, I think that's going to open up everything. If Julius Thomas is going to be able to go, this thing is going to be a Denver victory, correct?
I think it's going to be a victory, not because of Julius Thomas. I think people, and I see this a lot because I follow fantasy sports so much, he hasn't been good for 6 or 7 or 8 weeks. Either he didn't play or when he did play, he just wasn't very good. The hint or the suggestion is that ankle still isn't healthy, so he's been limited and he's been ineffective. He hasn't done much of anything, so I don't think he's really key. He's just another – there are so many weapons there. I mean, Wes Welker's non-existent. He's gone, and yet they still have tons of weapons there. For me, Indianapolis just doesn't provide much. They're not especially horrible against the pass or especially horrible against the run, though we have seen some games where they were really bad against the run. But as far as ranked NFL-wise, they're about middle of the pack. But they're not good at anything, really, and Denver has really run the ball extremely well, and at least in some of the games, Indianapolis looked terrible against the run. The Patriots shredded them to pieces with the running game, and that's what Denver wants to do. Actually, being up in New England, Bo said you don't bet against Peyton Manning. Actually, up in New England, we try to bet against him quite a bit. If we think that you put him in a big clutch game and he's going to choke, that's kind of the impression that we get up here.
Right.
He beat us a couple times. Also choked against us 3 or 4 times, too. But for me, it's about the running game. C.J. Anderson's doing great. That team is running well. And obviously, when you've got Demaryius Thomas and all those weapons, it makes it a lot easier to run. I just think Denver's just going to be able to run all over them. And Indianapolis isn't good enough. That's what the Patriots do, is the Patriots try to take away something and then make you win with your weaker parts. Indianapolis doesn't really have that many strong parts. They're kind of mediocre across the board. So like you said, unless Luck goes out and throws for 450, and I don't even think T.Y. Hilton's 100% healthy or at least 100% effective, I don't see how Indianapolis does it. I just don't think they have enough to be able to get it done. They don't have a running back. They might as well just run and shoot the thing and not even have a guy in the backfield. Trent Richardson is worthless. So he might as well just put another lineman or throw another receiver out there. So the running game is completely non-existent. I don't see how they get enough done to be able to overcome that, unless Peyton has a four INT game, which normally doesn't happen very often. He may have a bad game, and he's had more than his fair share the last month or 5 weeks. But three or four picks against a mediocre Indianapolis team, I don't see that coming.
Right, yeah. And the thing about this is, though, we've seen how to beat Denver. Seattle did it last year in the Super Bowl. They did it again this year, even though Peyton Manning did have that last-minute drive that actually put the thing into overtime. But what's kind of funny is you can have success against Denver defensively if you can be physical and take Peyton Manning out of his rhythm. You don't need the last thing you can do, Bo, is blitz Peyton Manning because he's too good for that.
Yeah,
it's basically play him straight up and use your size and your speed and your length to disrupt timing routes, and that's something that Indianapolis just doesn't have on defense. They're good, they're just not that good. And the thing, and we just highlighted, Chris just highlighted perfectly. They just lack substance on offense outside of Andrew Luck. He's got to, not only does he have to be perfect, he has to be more than perfect in order to pull this thing off. If there's any young quarterback in the league that can do it, it's him. This is just not a very good matchup. If this was in Indianapolis, and I really don't like to get into the whole home and road thing, but if this thing was in Indianapolis in that environment, that's a little bit more conducive for Andrew Luck. I don't think this environment is a very good environment for him to succeed. If it was in Indianapolis, I'd probably give him just a little bit better of an opportunity to beat the Broncos, but not this week, Bo.
No, not this week. I mean, you can't. If you have to rely on blitzes from your secondary and your linebackers to beat Peyton Manning, you're not going to beat him because you're going to see him coming every time.
No.
You've got to get him with a three- or four-man rush, maybe do some stunning along the defensive line to get to improve that pass rush. But if you're going to – if you have to send a linebacker or the safety in on a blitz, he's going to tear you apart.
Right. I mean, he's been doing it year after year after year. And that's the success is when you drop a safety into the box and use them in that inside protection against Julius Thomases and the crossing routes of Wes Welker and some of those underneath guys, because that's actually their running game. It's those timing routes underneath that actually brings you know, safeties in, and then it opens up everything on the outside for Emmanuel Sanders and Demaryius Thomas, which makes them completely lethal. And they also have that play action running game that they can mix in as well too. Certainly this is going to be something that, I mean, I wish Indianapolis the best, but well, they're not going to win this game.
Not happening.
Turning our attention finally to the NFC, and of course, we can't have a discussion without bringing up Bo's Dallas Cowboys. This week they traveled to Lambeau Field, and it's interesting because last week I didn't think they played all that well. As a matter of fact, the last couple weeks I don't think Dallas has really played all that well. Last week they completely got away from the running game because, again, Detroit's run defense is actually very good, and it was in a situation where the ball ended up being in Tony Romo's hands, and, well, he didn't necessarily throw up on himself like we are accustomed to seeing Tony Romo do that when the ball is in his hands. Very good. I guess you can say a very good. I wouldn't say it was a great game for Tony Romo. He minimized the mistakes. From that aspect, okay, that was good. They won a playoff game, so that's number two in his career. He goes up to Lambeau Field, not a very good environment for the Cowboys. This is going to be a game where they're going to have to use DeMarco Murray at least 30 times, control the clock, and make sure that Aaron Rodgers, number one, stays off the field. But when he is on the field, Dallas is going to have to bring the house in this game because you have a guy in Aaron Rodgers who I would probably say is not even close to being 100%. There is a slight tear in the calf, and I don't care how many weeks you have to recover. That thing is not a very good injury for a quarterback. It severely limits his athleticism, Bo, which means you're going to see a lot of quick releases. You're going to see a lot of quick snaps. I would probably assume that he's not going to sit back in the pocket and just have all day to pick apart the Cowboys secondary with guys like Jordy Nelson over the top, guys like that. It's going to be a heavy dose of Eddie Lacy. It's going to be timing routes. It's not going to be quintessential Green Bay offense because of it. And if that's the case, this is going to play right into Dallas's hands. But then again, it is Aaron Rodgers, and it's his calf that's injured, not his arm. I still think this is going to be a very good game. The line in this game is Green Bay is at home favored by 5.5. I like that line. I think that's a pretty good line. I don't think Green Bay is going to cover that. I think they're going to win, but I think it's immaterial in this game. This is going to be a very good game, Bo.
Yeah.
And I ultimately do believe that Green Bay is going to win this game. But, again, for Dallas to win this game, it is going to have to be a DeMarco Murray show. It's going to be Murray, and then, again, some more Murrays.
Right. Well, I mean, Dallas in that playoff game against Detroit was facing probably one of, if not the best defensive fronts in football. They stopped the run, and it's really the one time this year where a team has shut down DeMarco Murray to the point that Dallas got away from the running game. And if you look at where Dallas has struggled this season, it's because they got away from the running game. And really towards the, especially in December, this team did not stray away from that. They kept running the football. Even when DeMarco Murray got stuffed 2, 3, 4 times in a row, they still kept running the football. Now, in terms of this game, for Dallas to win, they've got to do a few things. Okay, we've already talked about the running game. They've got to eat clock on every drive they are. Because if you give Aaron Rodgers too many opportunities, he's going to shred your defense. With a bad calf or not, he's going to shred. So for Dallas to do this, they're going to have drives eat up quarters. Not just clock, eat up quarters. They're going to have to be able to run the football, get first downs, but you know what? Take every single set of downs all the way to third down to eat that clock down. Because you also talk about the Cowboys, the best third down conversion team in football. Take it to third down. You're good at it. That's how you eat clock. That's how you keep Aaron Rodgers off the field, and that's how you win this football game. But defensively, much like we talked about with the Colts, they're going to have to bring that pass rush with just their defensive line. That's what else Dallas is going to have to do. They're going to have to get pressure on Aaron Rodgers using nothing but that front four and allow their linebackers and the secondary to drop back and cover all these weapons that Aaron Rodgers has. I think if Dallas goes up there and wins, I don't think it's as big of an upset as a lot of people are making it out to be. I really just don't think that the Packers are vaunted, as someone on this panel said earlier today. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they are. Is it going to be a tough game? Absolutely. Is it going to be a physical game? Absolutely. Is it going to come down to the last drive of the game? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
But
I would say this. And Chris, the Dallas Cowboys were 8-0 on the road this year. Didn't really play anybody of consequence except the Seahawks, but they got the Seahawks at a time when the Seahawks were not playing like the Seahawks. They were dealing with the Percy Harvin situation. They were dealing with some turmoil at the time of trying to get over the Super Bowl victory and really just kind of trying to start off a season, being the hunted, not the hunter, all those different cliches. So the Seahawks weren't exactly in their right, playing the way that they were heading into the playoffs as, and even then it took a late touchdown for the Cowboys to see them on the road. Outside of that, maybe you can say the Eagles on the road, but for the most part, the Cowboys didn't play anybody of consequence on the road. And now they're asked to go into an environment that's not going to be conducive to them. They're going to be playing in Green Bay, where, I mean, granted, yes, recent history tells you that road teams can go into Lambeau and have success against Green Bay, but for the most part, traditionally speaking, it's not a place that's conducive for road teams to come into the playoffs and do it. And again, it's Aaron Rodgers, and I have to say this. Defensively, for the Dallas Cowboys, to me, it's going to be, can they put enough pressure on Aaron Rodgers and keep him inside the pocket and make sure that he's not allowed? I mean, I would probably assume, Chris, even with an injured calf, that there's still going to be some athleticism there with Aaron Rodgers. But if you can keep him inside the pocket and you can contain him and maybe contain a little bit of Eddie Lacy, I would probably assume that Dallas is going to come out victorious. But again, right in the back of my mind, though, Chris, it's Aaron Rodgers. And this is, to me, this is a bad matchup for that, for, I guess you can say, an overachieving Dallas Cowboy defense.
Yeah, overachieving is a fair way to put it. I think, and this shocks me, because I've never had much faith in Jason Garrett as a coach, but for him to change his philosophy, and I think he has this year, and go so heavy on the run game, and it makes perfect sense for them to do that. I'm not saying that Jason Garrett's a genius for doing it. I'm just surprised that he did it. I've never had any faith in Jason Garrett at all. And with that offensive line and with how talented DeMarco Murray is, what they've done is exactly what they should have done. I just didn't think that Jason Garrett would be able to do it. I never thought he was much of a coach, so I figured he'd screw it up. But this is a great matchup, and I do wonder about Aaron Rodgers. I think that really is the key. How much is the health going to impact the game? Because if you look at this, it's the perfect matchup. Green Bay doesn't have a great defense. The Cowboys don't have a great defense. Green Bay is a big play with one of, if not the best quarterback in the game. And then the Cowboys have a mediocre defense but a great running game. It's the perfect matchup. And you would think going to Green Bay, if it is bad weather, if it impacts the way you play the game, if it's tougher to throw the ball, then you combine the injury to Rodgers. If he can't move out, he's really good outside the pocket. He's not what you would call a running quarterback, but when he gets outside the pocket,
right,
he makes plays. That's something he's really good at.
Yeah.
Normally, you look at this matchup and you say, if it wasn't the Cowboys and their history of blowing it or their history of just having high expectations and low production, you would think that this is a game that Dallas could definitely win. You laid it all out. They're going to run the ball. They're going to eat the clock. They're going to dominate in the running game because that offensive line is so good. This is a game Dallas can absolutely win. So if we didn't have all the baggage of what the Cowboys used to be like, you would think, because Dallas, I mean, Romo's having a great, efficient season. He hasn't choked this year. Dez Bryant is as good as you get, if not better. He's physical. He's fast. He's size. He's so big. He's so tough to cover. Add DeMarco Murray is one of the most complete all-around players in the league this year. Dallas is probably the better team, to be honest with you,
probably,
when you look at all of those
probably
things. So the question really is, how, because that defense has really been covered. The running game has really protected that defense. It's not a great defense.
Yep.
It's ranked pretty well, but I think you said it best. They really have been sheltered. That defense is worse than the numbers suggest, and yet if they keep running the ball and they keep doing it, you'd have to think Dallas can dominate this game. And it's a great matchups game, and we'll just, if Aaron Rodgers can only play at 70%, maybe that's enough to get Dallas over the hump, but offense is so easy to pick. You know, you see a great player like Aaron Rodgers and Jordy Nelson and Randall Cobb and even Davante Adams, and they can even run the ball with Lacy as well. It's hard to pick against offense, but I think if one thing we should have learned, and we keep learning it, and yet it seems to always keep surprising us, offense can get stopped. And I wonder if that can be the case, because Dallas doesn't have the defense, but they have the running game to minimize it.
What's funny about this, Chris, is I asked Bo this. I told Bo this is the truth about this game. If Dallas can hold Aaron Rodgers to under 30 points, they'll win this game.
Yeah.
If Aaron Rodgers does what Aaron Rodgers is conducive, and by the way, I think the Packers average something crazy, like 38 points at home. I mean, it's a ridiculous number. At home, if they can hold Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay offense under 30 points, they'll win this game. I truly believe that because, again, it starts with clock management, and the best way to keep Aaron Rodgers, you know, to minimize Aaron Rodgers' damage is to keep him off the field. So you would probably expect from that standpoint there's going to be a heavy dose of DeMarco Murray, which is fine. But it's minimizing Aaron Rodgers' damage when he's actually on the field, and I think This is quintessential Aaron Rodgers. It's a quick strike offense. That's what they do. They love to go vertical. They mix in the play action, which is another component that's going to be in this game. Because you know, if Dallas's defense tries to key up on Eddie Lacy, it's just going to open up the play action. And we've seen exactly just how dangerous that's going to be for Green Bay. They score a lot of points off the play action. So what's kind of funny about this is it all gets back to what can they take away from Green Bay's offense? What can they do to put the onus on Aaron Rodgers? If they can somehow take away a little bit of Eddie Lacy, they're going to be able to do that, though. They're going to be able to keep. They're going to be able to keep the Packers under 30 points. But I'll tell you what: if Eddie Lacy goes off, it's just going to make it. It's just going to make it that much harder to keep Green Bay from under 30. And if they score over 30, I'm sorry, Bo, the Cowboys are not going to advance. But if they can hold it, keep them under 30, they'll advance, dude.
Well, you know, I think when you look at this defense, okay, and you really just open the microscope and look at what they're good at, what they're bad at. They're good against the run.
We're talking about Dallas' defense, correct?
Right, yeah, we're talking about Dallas' defense. Okay, Dallas has been good against the run. You know, the defensive front, the linebackers are playing a good year. Where they get in trouble, it's not the vertical game, but it's the slot receiver. It's the guy that gets 10, 15 yards on a slant. That's where Dallas really struggles. Their linebackers do not cover well in that open area in the middle of the field. On the edges, it's hit or miss. I mean, they're not a dominant secondary, not even close. But they are better against the vertical than they are against the short. And if Aaron Rodgers is going to stick to the vertical, you're going to see some incompletions. You're going to see some problems for Aaron Rodgers and the Packers. But if they can hit the slots, if they can hit the middle of the field, 10, 15 yards down the field, they can march right down the field on Dallas and do it quickly.
Right. I Chris just handled this perfectly. He basically just said, listen, this is if you're a matchups guy, this is a perfect matchup because it's two mediocre defenses with two very good offenses. And so really it's going to be number one, who's going to create the first turnover, or B, it's going to be, you know, which defense is going to be able to step up and deliver that three and out when they need it in crunch time. And I guess it just depends on which defense you like more, I guess. At that point it becomes a coin flip. To me, it's like what quarterback do you prefer? And of course I prefer Rodgers over Romo, just because there's a better track record in the playoffs with Rodgers versus with Romo. So you just never know exactly what you're going to get, because we've seen so much bad football with Tony Romo that we just know that, yeah, okay, that's great, he's had a good season, but we also know that he can throw up on himself as good as the best vomiters out there. So I would say from that standpoint, Chris hit this one right on the head, but at the end of the day, Bo, I'm going to take Green Bay in this game, but then again, would it surprise me if Dallas won? No, it wouldn't surprise me. I'm taking the Packers, but it wouldn't surprise me if the Green Bay Packers won. Let's move on to the fourth game of championship weekend. Of course, it's the Carolina Panthers coming to my hometown, Seattle, Washington, to take on the defending Super Bowl champions. Does Carolina have a puncher's chance, Bo, at all?
No? I'm going to give them a slight, and I mean slight chance. It's a matchup that, you know, I think that Carolina could be successful, but the question is, can that defense stop Russell Wilson from chewing them up? I mean, that to me is this game. You know, I think the Cardinals will be able to put up some points against Seattle's defense. Can Carolina's defense rein in that Seattle attack with Lynch and Russell Wilson? Can they do that? I don't think so. I don't think so. And I think that's where this is probably going to go bad for Carolina. I give them a slight chance just because I think Cam Newton and that offense can score some points against Seattle. But at the end of the day, it's going to be Seattle.
Chris, what's funny about this is Seattle right now is playing defense the way that everybody expects them to play. It was like in the first half of the season, they were just kind of going through the motions, just trying to get back to that edge, try to get that swagger back. They were going through the motions of dealing with some of the, you know, some inside, you know, inside locker room issues. But finally, Seattle put it all together. I think it was right after the Chiefs game where they had that team meeting. And ever since then, Seattle has been basically as dominant as we've seen them last year on the road to a Super Bowl. This year, coming into this playoff game, In order for me to give Carolina even a puncher's chance, the one thing that they've done great over these last five wins is they've been able to run the football, and they've been able to run the football effectively, not just with Cam Newton's ability, as an athletic quarterback, but Jonathan Stewart's been able to get to go off a little bit as a running back. But unfortunately, Seattle's bread and butter is to take away any sense of a running game, and he puts the onus on a quarterback to beat the Legion of Boom, to beat that secondary. And right now, Seattle's pass rush is getting to the quarterback at a pretty high clip, which makes it even more tougher for quarterbacks to beat them. Going into this environment at CenturyLink Field, I got to be honest with you, Chris, Cam Newton is going to have to be, we talked about Andrew Luck needing to be even more than perfect. You're going to have to be even more than perfect to go into Seattle and beat the Seahawks right now. This isn't just about the Seahawks defense, because Seattle offensively, Chris, they don't light the world on fire. I mean, they rely heavily on Marshawn Lynch, and I'm sure that they're going to have a heavy dose of beast mode. To me, this is probably, I mean, the Vegas line right now is 11, and I can see a 20-9 ball game. I can easily see the Seahawks winning 20-9, but to me, this is not about what the Seahawks are going to do. It's about what the Panthers can do coming across country to play the Seahawks. I got to be honest with you, man. I don't think Cam Newton has it in his DNA to be better than perfect into this game. I just think this is going to be, if Carolina will be lucky to score 9 points. Put it that way.
Yeah, with Luck, I think he actually has to go out and have a big game, not just be perfect as in efficient and not make mistakes and have a good game. I think Luck has to go above and beyond and have a great game. With Cam Newton, I think he has to avoid losing the game and also avoid making mistakes, and he has to make sure that Seattle doesn't get in good field position. I think Cam Newton has to make sure that he keeps the field position game competitive so that the defense can keep it close. Because really, the whole thing with this matchup and the only way that Carolina can win is if it's 13-9 like it was early in the season. Or one of those
right.
games, which is what Carolina – one of the reasons why everyone thinks this could be a game. And I think there's a good chance this is the biggest blowout of the weekend because Seattle's defense could create points and it could just get completely out of control. Carolina has to make sure that doesn't happen. So they have to play good defense and then offensively just move the ball just enough where they don't necessarily score a lot of points, but they make sure that they can punt it away and Seattle isn't starting on the 40 all the game long. And I'm not even sure Cam Newton can do that, to be honest with you. I don't think he has to go out and throw for 400 yards, but he can't throw any picks. He can't go 3-and-out inside the 10. You know, those kinds of things. He's got to move the chains just enough to allow his defense to keep the game close. And even then, I'm not sure, so sure they can win, but that's how it has to go. It has to be 10-7 in the fourth or 13-10, and then all of a sudden a key turnover or some weird play all of a sudden gives the team to get a chance at the end of the game. I really think this game has to be very close the entire way, and then somehow something goes right for Carolina to win. And I actually think it's going to go the opposite way. I think Carolina's going to try and try and try, but there's going to be a couple mistakes. I don't think Jonathan Stewart's going to run at all. I don't think Cam Newton's going to be able to make any big plays, even to Benjamin, who's a very talented wide receiver. I just don't think anything, those things are going to happen. So I think just Carolina's going to be punting and punting and punting again. And I think Newton's going to make some mistakes, which is going to lead to easy points. And the next thing you know, it's the third quarter and Seattle's up, you know, 30-7 or something, and the game's over. It just looks like that's an easy way for this game to go.
Yep. And what's interesting, what even gets more interesting, the reason why I don't really like this matchup, Bo, is because Carolina's already offensively challenged, I guess you can say, just because, you know, they make the decision not to bring back Steve Smith. Okay, that's fine. They roll with Kelvin Benjamin. They bring in Jericho Crotcherty, and they team him up with Greg Olsen. The thing I really don't like about this is because with Seattle's ability to really take away running games and put the onus on the quarterback, you would probably would assume that they're going. I mean, and by the way, the matchup with Greg Olsen I don't like because Seattle has not really done well. They don't have a good even with as good as the defense they had, they really don't have a good track record against tight ends. But you probably would have to figure that Seattle is going to use Cam Chancellor in that role against tight ends. They'll probably do their best to probably use Bobby Wagner in that situation in the middle of the field to kind of mitigate that damage. They'll take their chances on the outside with Kelvin Benjamin, but the reason why I don't like this matchup is because Seattle's pass rush is going to force Cam Newton to the edges. And once that happens, it doesn't matter even if you have a hint of weapon, even if you have the hint of weapons, once you get into the open space, Seattle's so long and so fast and so physical that quarterbacks go to die on the edges. And this is that's why I really don't like this matchup. Even if you told me that maybe even Jonathan Stewart had a little success, you still have to deal with the pass rush, and that's where I think Carolina's offense is going to go to die in this game. And like I said, 9 points. They'd be happy to walk out of this game with 9 points.
Well, it is the playoffs, Steve, and we can, all three of us can talk about how the NFC South really
no chance. They got no
really,
chance.
No chance.
No,
I'm going to give them the slimmest chance I could possibly give a team because it's the playoffs. You never say never in the playoffs. You just don't do it. I don't care what the matchup is. You never know.
Breaking news, gentlemen. Breaking news coming in via the wire. Darren Carrington, Oregon wide receiver, has been suspended for the national title game. Does this hurt Oregon's chances? Does this impact Oregon's chances in the national title game, Bo?
Well, it's certainly an impact. I mean, I don't see how it couldn't possibly be an impact. Is it going to cost them the game? I don't think so. I don't think it's such a huge hit that Ohio State's just going to be able to just run all over them now. But it's going to have an impact. Of course it will.
Chris, I know that we were just switching gears a little bit from the pro ranks down to the college ranks, but if you told me this was Marcus Mariota suspended for the national title game, I probably could say that there's a lot of impact to this one. Although Darren Carrington actually did have a pretty decent season, he gives that extra element of speed on the outside. I actually like the dude, but I don't know if this is going to have as much of impact on this game. And I know that we're switching gears here, talking a little bit about the national championship game. I'll just say this. I hope Ohio State has a very – I mean, there's – I hope they have a very good game plan to the speed of what Oregon is going to throw at them. Listen, this is the Tom Brady conversation all over again. You don't bet against Tom Brady, and I hate to say this, you don't bet against Urban Meyer. I've learned long ago not to bet against Urban Meyer. As much as I love the Ducks, Chris, as much as I love the Oregon Ducks, and you know me, I rep the Pac-12 just like anything else. The suspension is what it is, but I will say this. Oregon is still going to play a very good ball game against Ohio State, and I really want to pick the Ducks in this game. I really do, but it's Urban Meyer. And you know what? A third-string quarterback beat Wisconsin in the Big Ten championship game, and a third-string quarterback beat Nick Saban in the Sugar Bowl. And just when you think that Oregon is down, Ohio State is down. They climb right back into it, and they end up doing what most Urban Meyer teams do, which is win and win big. I'm at a loss here, Chris. I'm at a loss here for the national championship game. I want to pick Oregon, but I just can't do it yet. What do you got in this game?
I mean, when you look at it, it's hard to – you look at how talented Oregon is, it's really hard to pick against them, against anybody except for, like, in Alabama, because Alabama seems to be as talented as a lot of other teams. So you look at it, and it looks like Oregon goes in with the better team. And how do you pick against the better team? And yet, like you said, Urban Meyer continues to win, even though he looks overmatched. It looks like just defensively and running the ball and game planning and coaching, and it just seems like he's just that good of a coach that he overcomes the fact that they don't seem to match up on the field. I do always wonder, and Oregon is a little bit unique in this way, because Alabama, I think, is more talented than Ohio State. I think most people would probably agree with that. But Oregon brings something different. I mean, they bring a style and a pace. Yeah. To the game that nobody else does. Even if there are other teams that try to do it, nobody does it quite like them. And I wonder, you could see how if Urban Meyer is truly a great coach, that he could find a way to foil that or find a way to slow them down. But how do you do that? I don't see an obvious solution to that. So I'll be fascinated to see if he does come out there and find a way to slow this team down, because he's going to have to. And that's what it's hard. It's hard to bet against him because he keeps winning. But it's hard to see how he's going to do that.
What's funny about this, Bo, is Florida State tried to do it. They tried to run the football. They tried to kind of grind it out. They tried to grind it out a little bit in the Rose Bowl, and Oregon was able to mitigate even that. What I will say about this is I don't think there's a team right now in the nation that's playing better than Ohio State, although you could easily make a case for Oregon because they're playing incredibly well right now as well, too. The problem that I have with this was, as Chris just alluded to, Bo, maybe Urban Meyer can find a way to kind of, you know, to figure out a way to slow it down. But the problem is their offense is pretty fast paced as well. That's the issue. I wouldn't say they're as quick striking as Oregon, but they also are a fast paced offense as well too. They like to put points on the board, and you know they basically like to play defense like every college team in the team, which is basically okay. That's cool. We're just going to try to outscore you. If we win 44-22, that's cool. We don't mind giving up 3 touchdowns, 4 touchdowns a game, as long as we make a stop here and there. You know, as long as our defense can make stops when we need them to make stops, that's cool. Put the ball back in the offense, and we're going to score more points. But what's kind of funny about this, you know, that's, you know, it almost seems like this game is going to be this is going to be poised, you know, poised to be a shootout, and it's going to come down to either a turnover, or if B, one of these defenses can get a stop in the second half. And I guess the question is, which defense do you prefer more? Obviously, I know exactly how Oregon is going to try to play. And it worked very well in the Rose Bowl. I would probably assume they're going to have the exact same game plan going in against Ohio State. And again, Bo, I really just want to pick Oregon. I know Oregon can win this game, and they can either win it big or they can win it close. But yet, it's Urban Meyer. It's Urban Meyer. You know what I mean?
I know.
It's Urban.
I know it's difficult to pick against Urban Meyer, but I still like Oregon in this game. I think that Oregon's going to have the same game plan, like you mentioned, defensively, that they had in the Rose Bowl. They're going to do it again. and it's going to be very successful. I think that is what's going to decide this game.
Look at what they were able to do in the Rose Bowl when they were finally able to dial up a few turnovers. They turned that around into 24 points in the second half. And what's kind of funny is Jameis Winston actually had a pretty decent game in that Rose Bowl, but they were able just to dial up a few turnovers, and it completely swung the tide. I think it was like a 24-point third quarter in the Rose Bowl. Basically, I think it came off, what, three turnovers? I mean, it was something ridiculous, and that's exactly how Oregon plays football. Sometimes defensively it's not pretty, Chris. Sometimes Oregon's defense can get the best of them at times. It did earlier this year against Arizona. Their defense let them down. But for the most part, this is a defense that really, it's not going to light the world on fire, but it's consistent. It's good enough to win ball games, and if they can dial up a turnover or two, then all of a sudden you have Marcus Mariota who knows exactly what to do. But the problem is what Urban Meyer has basically said all year, whether it's been JT Barrett or whether it's been, you know, whether it's been this third string freshman that's playing the game right now, they preach high percentage passes, do not turn over the ball. And you know what Ohio State just doesn't do? They don't turn over the ball. So again, I'm going with Oregon. I'm taking Oregon, Chris. I'm taking them. That's it. I'm just taking Oregon. I'm trying to talk my way.
I think you have to take Oregon. They just look so much. I mean, they look better. I think you have to take Oregon. I do wonder about this, and this is one thing about football that makes it interesting, is there are certain matchups that you can lose. And so even though the more talented team is supposed to win every game, If one team, even the lesser talented one, wins a certain matchup, you can overcome some of the weaknesses on the other side or in other places. If, you know, the reputation of the two conferences, for example, the Pac-12, you look at the Pac-12, that's supposed to be a soft, athletic kind of conference, and the Big Ten or whatever it is now is supposed to be a physical one. I wonder if Ohio State can dominate the offensive line, can Oregon still do what they do, even though their offensive line gets dominated by Ohio State's defensive line? Can they run screens and bubble screens and all those kinds of things and just out-athlete the Ohio State and diminish whether the Ohio State defensive line can dominate? Can Ohio State dominate the lines, and can Oregon overcome that? That's the only thing that I can see. If they just get mashed on the line and they just can't throw the ball enough, they just can't get into their offense because Ohio State dominates in the first 5 yards of every play. I wonder if that's how Ohio State does it. But other than that, Oregon just looks much better. They look like the most talented team left. I thought Alabama would be better. I wasn't really impressed with Alabama in that game against Ohio State. So maybe Alabama wasn't as good as I thought they were. But Oregon seems like the clear number two, and now obviously the clear number one. I don't know how you pick against Oregon, really. I don't see it.
Right.
They're just so much more talented than everybody else.
And I think when this game goes down, this will probably be the best national championship game we've seen in at least 10 years. This is actually going to shape up to be a very good national championship game. But now that we've moved past all the football, let's take the football and let's just put it where it belongs and all that good stuff. We're baseball guys, so let's just go ahead and centrally focus this conversation right now on baseball. And I got a few questions. I wouldn't say it's a rapid fire. I'm going to throw out some questions, and I want some quick answers. Okay, so I want to know. I got a few questions that I've been brewing. It's been circulating a little bit. So I kind of want to touch on some of these subjects. So I want to know from you guys, and question number one, as we get into our Major League Baseball conversation here on the program, I want to know, question number one, which team up to this point has had the best offseason? We're going to start with Bo Reed. Bo? Let's start with Chris.
Which team's had the best offseason?
Let's start with Chris. You went MIA on us for there for a second. I'm glad you're okay. So now that you're back, okay, we're gonna start. The best team, the team that had the best offseason up to this point is who?
San Diego.
Chris.
I think based on expectations and based on what they were last year as opposed to what they are now, I like what the Chicago White Sox did.
Ooh. I'm actually going to say
that's a good one.
I'm actually going to say that's a very good. I was actually going with either the White Sox or the Boston Red Sox. I actually kind of like what they did with the rotation, considering how it left off. I'm going to go with I'm actually going to go with the Chicago White Sox. I hate to agree with Chris, but it's a toss-up. It's a toss-up between the Red Sox and the White Sox, but I think I would probably give the slight edge to the White Sox. Question number two, who is the biggest which team had the biggest acquisition? Let me rephrase this. The biggest acquisition of the offseason is who? And we'll start with Chris this time.
That's a tough one because I don't love this market. To be honest, I don't love the market. I think one of the biggest, the best signings was when the Tigers traded for Price for essentially nothing. But that didn't happen in the offseason. Mm-hmm. That happened last year. If they were able to keep Scherzer and now they add Price for a full season, I think that could be a very impactful situation for them. If you look at all the stars, I think the Red Sox filled a lot of needs. So, again, I really think it's Price. I think that keeps the Tigers competitive in the division, even if they don't keep Scherzer. And then if they go ahead and sign him, then once again, they're probably the favorite for the Central. And without Price, I don't think they would be they'd maybe be the favorite for the Central, but they wouldn't be a team that you would look as a World Series team. So, oddly, I guess I'd have to say that, is that adding a big piece like Price, probably the biggest move that will impact 2015.
All right. Bo, the biggest offseason acquisition was what?
I think you'd also argue Samardzija. when Bo gets back, he maybe having some technical difficulties. Samardzija going to the White Sox is a pretty big one, too.
Do you know who my biggest offseason acquisition was? Bo, are you back?
Nelson Cruz, Seattle. Cruz, Seattle.
You're saying Nelson Cruz to Seattle was the biggest offseason acquisition. I like it. Thanks for showing me a little love up here in the Pacific Northwest. I'm actually going to go with the acquisition that the Chicago Cubs... Say that again?
For me, yeah.
Okay. The biggest acquisition for me was when the Chicago Cubs got Joe Maddon, the manager, from the Tampa Bay Rays. I think there's going to be a very different mentality that the Cubs are going to have. And we talk about John Lester. We talk about some of the guys that the pieces that they brought back, whether it's Jason Hamill, or even bringing in Miguel Montero to be behind the plate. I think Joe Maddon being the manager of the Chicago Cubs is going to be number one, good for the veterans that are coming into the fold, but also good for the young guys. We know his track record with young players down in Tampa. I think this actually is going to be the biggest offseason acquisition for any team was Joe Maddon going to the Chicago Cubs as manager. Yeah, I said it. A manager, not a player. Who is going to be the biggest underrated signing of the offseason? Bo? Bo? Okay.
The underrated player or the team or what underrated in what sense?
The most underrated signing of the offseason. Oh, Chris, are you there?
We have technical difficulties from time to time on Blog Talk Radio. I always blame it on that.
We do. So what's your biggest underrated signing of the offseason? Bo?
And I'm back, I think.
Chris, are you there? Okay.
I'm here.
Okay, so now that we have everybody in the fold, this is good. I'm sorry for the technical difficulties. The most underrated signing of the offseason was who, Bo?
Most underrated. You know, I'm gonna go with Masterson in Boston.
Chris?
I think Masterson's a good one. I think it's probably Adam LaRoche. I think he got signed and people didn't even realize it. He's not a superstar player, but he's a good player. I think he had the water offense, and that's a great park to hit in. So I think because no one even paid attention or even, I think, realized that he signed there, he's a good player, has had a good career, and should help a lot. I also like Ervin Santana in Minnesota. I think that's a really good park to pitch in. I think he's underappreciated. I think he's comparable to some of the stats work, and Ervin Santana compares reasonably well to guys like Shields and Lester over the last 4 years. So he went for 4 years and $54 million, which is a third of what Lester got. So I think that's a pretty good deal as well, but that was a little bit more high profile, whereas LaRoche just went completely ignored.
Right.
I think it's LaRoche followed by possibly Ervin Santana.
I actually like the re-signing of Phil Hughes in Minnesota because I think that was a very underrated signing. It didn't get a lot of press, but Phil Hughes going to Minnesota resurrected his career, and slowly but surely he's actually developing into the ace that he wasn't in New York. I actually think that was a very underrated re-extension. The other name that I want to bring up is actually the name that Bo thought was the best off-season signing, which to me is a very underrated signing because there's a lot of people that think that, number one, the contract was just a little too large, and that also that those numbers are not going to translate into Safeco Field. But I actually think Nelson Cruz is going to be a very underrated signing, and I actually think that because of what everybody thinks is a negative is actually going to end up being a positive. But you with the name that I really like, though, I like Brandon McCarthy with the L.A. Dodgers. That was a very under-the-rating signing. And we saw exactly what happened when Brandon McCarthy ended up with New York last season. He was able to develop that cutter to go along with some of the secondary pitches that he already had in the fold. And he really learned how to pitch. And now if Brandon McCarthy can stay healthy, the Dodgers got themselves a very good starter for a very low price. That could end up very well being the most underrated signing of the offseason. Let's move on to this other question. And what was the biggest impact trade of the offseason?
Ooh, you know, I think the Kemp trade.
Matt Kemp?
I think the Kemp trade. The Dodgers finally are starting to sort out that outfield, and the Padres get a guy that can put him in the middle of the order if he's still got something left.
Matt Kemp. So you like the Matt Kemp a little bit better than the Justin Upton deal then?
Yeah.
Chris, the best trade so far this offseason was what?
There were so many, actually. As much as the signings were interesting, I didn't really love a lot of the free agents. There were a lot of really good trades, and it depends on how you want to grade it. Do you want to grade it on a curve? For example, Matt Latos going to the Marlins. I think that they got him for basically nothing, I thought, and that they could be competitive because of him. If he was having some elbow issues last year and his velocity was down. If he's in decline, then he's just a decent pitcher. But if he can get back to what he was in his better days, all of a sudden the Marlins got a number two type pitcher, and I don't think they really gave anything at him. So if you want to look at a little bit of a grade on the curve, you can do that. I don't think you love the Justin Upton trade or you love the Kemp trade, except for in combination with all of them. So you look at all of the trades the Padres did, they completely revamped a horrendous offense, and they traded their way into an offensive outfield of Myers, Kemp, and Upton. That's pretty good. So in combination all of those, that's great. Then Josh Donaldson going to Toronto. They didn't really need him, but they get a home run hitter in addition to Batista and Encarnacion. That's a powerful lineup right now. That one single trade is very fascinating. Well, I'm not sure how to pick each one's. But if I had to, I'd probably say Latos because I think they got him for free.
Yeah.
And the Marlins, without spending a ton of money, I think is a competitive. Why they gave away Andrew Heaney to the Dodgers is bad. I don't know. But the fact that they add Latos, I think that makes them a lot more competitive, and it didn't cost them anything to do it.
Right. And they also got D. Gordon, which I got to be honest with you. I was not a big fan of what the Dodgers did of getting Jimmy Rollins and also getting Howie Kendrick. I think those two players are like literally on the backside of their career. I understand why they did it. But me personally, I like D. Gordon. I think he brings a lot of value to any team. And, of course, he now goes to the Marlins. And quietly, the Marlins put together a very, very, very good offseason. To me, I think the Jason Hayward deal, I thought that was good for both teams. But I think it's even better for St. Louis because – Listen, say what you will about Jason Hayward, but defensively, you know, you actually get a very, very good plus above replacement level defender. And plus going to a team like St. Louis where you can actually just blend. You don't actually have to be that dude. You're not going to necessarily grab those headlines. There's other guys in that lineup that can do it. He's just going to be one of those dudes that's going to blend in. And he's going to – I think going to from Atlanta to St. Louis will basically be – pretty much what everybody else, what happened when they got traded to St. Louis, everything just turns up gold. I think Jason Hayward to St. Louis is just going to be fantastic. I got a few baseball questions that I think are fun to answer. So let's go ahead and do this. If everything breaks right for Felix Hernandez, i.e. he stays healthy and avoids a big time injury, is Felix Hernandez a Hall of Famer? Yes or no? And we'll start with Chris.
Absolutely. He's been the – not only did he start his career young, so not only should he be able to – assuming all the things you just said, assuming all of those assumptions, yes, he started young. He's been extremely dominant. The only harm is that he played on some teams that weren't very good in Seattle, and that often hurts a guy. But he should put together such a long career, and with Seattle getting better and better, he should have some pretty impressive days, some potential championship-caliber teams, whether they win it all or not. It's kind of a crapshoot when you get there. But as long as you get to the playoffs enough, absolutely. Minus injury with how good he's been, unless he completely falls off the table, absolutely, he's on pace. He's going to have a long enough career to do it for sure.
Bo?
You talk about one of, if not the most dominant pitchers for how long now? Of course he's a Hall of Famer.
Well,
I mean, any questions?
Well, listen, I mean, you understand how this works. The Hall of Fame, the Baseball Writers Association, it's a hodgepodge of different voters. So you still have some guys that are very Saber, that are very Saber-centric, so you have that. Okay, so that's fine. But you also have some guys that are voting that also look at win totals and ERA and things like that. So the problem with Felix Hernandez and a potential candidacy is, when it's all said and done, is he going to have the wins that reflect that of, I guess you can say, quote-unquote, Hall of Fame pitchers? Of course, personally, he's going to be I would probably assume that he's going to be a first-ballot Hall of Famer if all things break even, regardless if he never wins a championship in Seattle. I'll just say it, because the numbers are going to show more than a decade worth of dominance, and right now he is considered the best pitcher in the American League, if not Major League Baseball. If not the entire league. So, yeah, I would probably assume that he would be a Hall of Famer. But because he plays in Seattle, and you never know if he's ever going to win a championship here, and because he's been playing with some putrid offenses, it begs the question. But I'm glad that you guys both think he is, because I believe he's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. Question number two, when it comes to these Hall of Fame questions, was Pedro Martinez a better pitcher than Randy Johnson, Bo?
Say that one more time.
Was Pedro Martinez a better pitcher than Randy Johnson?
No.
Ooh, really?
No.
Ooh, Pedro in his prime?
I would take the big unit over Pedro any day.
Chris?
Not in his prime. Pedro at his best was one of the best ever, I think you would argue. Now,
right,
if you want to take a career, Pedro's career is relatively short. Some people argue that.
Yes.
Everyone talks about how he was an automatic Hall of Famer, but it's kind of the Sandy Koufax argument. He did extremely well, but not really a large sample. So if you want to take the overall career, Randy was dominant for a lot longer, stayed healthy longer. But at his peak, the best 2 or 3 years, Pedro was, I think someone said, 3 ERA points better than the entire league during the steroid era when everyone was bashing homers. I don't think you ever see a pitcher that dominant in any era. So Pedro in the best 2 or 3 years in the American League East, in Fenway Park, during the steroid era, I don't think anyone has been that good. So if you just want to look at the peaks, Pedro's the best of all time probably. But the career,
well, what's kind of,
you really don't match Randy. I mean, he was so good for so long. The career itself, if you want to take one player for their entire career and try to have a better organization, Randy did it longer at an elite level for a really long time.
You know what's kind of funny about this, Bo, because you and I reside in the AL West, so we saw a lot of Randy Johnson out here.
Yeah,
a lot of Randy Johnson. I saw him firsthand, and I don't think I've ever seen a left-handed pitcher that is dominant as Randy Johnson. This dude was absolutely evil with that slider.
Oh, yeah.
Listen, once he developed the change to go along with the slider and the fastball, Randy Johnson was a Hall of Famer as far as I was concerned. But the thing about this was, for as evil and dominant as Randy was in the regular season, and he won, I think, what, like 5 Cy Youngs, something crazy like that, 4 or 5 Cy Youngs. Randy Johnson did not have the postseason success until 2001, when him and Schilling won the World Series in 2001.
Right.
And then even after that, when he left Arizona, went to New York, didn't necessarily really have the postseason success that you would like to see with a dude that has been so dominant. But Pedro had not only – he was right, Chris is right, the small sample size for the career, but – not only was he able to do amazing things in the regular season, but he was also pretty decent in the postseason as well too. I think he was a little bit better in the postseason than Randy Johnson was in the postseason. I thought he had better performances in the postseason than Randy Johnson ever had in the postseason. Both of them got rings, but I will say this: when I talk to old-time baseball players, the guys that I'm talking like the real, real old timers. Like, I'll give you a good example, okay? My grandfather and this is how you know. My grandfather was a big baseball nut, and when he was a kid, he actually saw Walter Johnson at the end of his career, not in the prime of his career, but the end of his career. He still had some good life to his fastball, but for the most part, he was a shell of his former self. But we're talking about a man who saw Walter Johnson pitch, saw Satchel Paige pitch, saw Drysdale, saw Koufax, saw Whitey Ford, saw some of the best pitchers, Bob Gibson, saw some of the best pitchers to ever play this game, and he basically said, listen, the two best pitchers that I've seen in my lifetime, and by the way, when he passed at 2004, he saw Pedro in his prime from like 99 to 2001, and he basically said, listen, for as much as I watch baseball and play this game, I've seen only three pitchers that brought it, and that was Sandy Koufax, Bob Gibson, and Pedro Martinez, and he saw Randy pitch. Saw Randy pitch in his prime as well, too, and said, listen, man, got to hand it to Randy. He's the man, I'll tell you what. But nothing was better than Pedro Martinez. Pedro owned everybody that he wanted to own, and when he finally harnessed that changeup, it was all over. It was all over. Pedro in his prime, there is nobody better than Pedro in his prime. And Chris said it, playing at a park like Fenway, where pitchers don't have that type of success, unbelievable. What he was able to do, unbelievable. Unbelievable. Pedro in his prime, better than Clemens, and Clemens was fantastic, man. Better than Clemens. Better than Smoltz, better than Glavine, better than Maddux, who was absolutely fantastic the postseason. Pedro in his prime. So, Pedro in his prime.
I'm still begging Randy. I'm taking the hard-throwing, tall, hard-throwing left-hander who made Hall of Fame hitters look silly with his slider. I'm taking him.
Listen, I love the big unit, man. Randy, to me, definitely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. There's no conversation about his Hall of Fame worthiness. There's no question about that. But Randy in his prime versus Pedro in his prime, both of them you would hand Game 7 in a World Series to. There's no doubt about it. You would easily give them the ball, and you know for a fact that you probably have the best chance to win. But I don't think I've ever seen a dude – and Randy was dominant, Chris. Dominant. But there was Randy dominant, and then there was Pedro dominant. Like I said, man, once he developed that changeup, it was all over. Because he can mix and match speeds, and it was you hit, like even if you knew what was coming, you still couldn't hit it. That's how dominant he was. Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of almost a silly argument because they're both awesome. Randy Johnson was as good as you get, and really, if you wanted to put Randy Johnson up against a left-handed lineup, he probably dominate them more than Pedro would, just because with how big he was in the slider. And if you put him in a heavy lefty lineup, maybe Randy is better that night for sure. But they're both just amazingly good. It's just different styles. It's easy to like Pedro a little bit better also, because he brought it with a changeup and a curveball and a fastball. So he brought kind of the whole package, whereas Randy seemed to be more power. So you just purely 6'10", 97, and then a slider that was unhittable. And those nasty sliders, they're power pitches.
Yep.
So I can see how it's easy to appreciate Pedro, but, I mean, any given night, I mean, Randy was so dominant sometimes, especially against lefties, that you could just say there's no way they are going to hit him. There's just no way. And so if you want to argue, Randy, I'm not going to say that you're stupid by any means. I think these guys are just both so dominantly good. But I just think on any given night when Pedro was at his best, I mean, in 2000, he had a 1.74 ERA in the American League. He threw 217 innings. 1.74 during the steroid era. 2000 was in the heart of the steroid era. That's when home runs were exploding. 1.74, that is just silly. It's really, and he threw four shutouts that year. I mean, it's an argument of trying to nitpick between two insanely good people.
Pedro
at his best was sick.
Do you know who doesn't get a lot of pub? Mike Mussina, for some reason. The Moose, I remember there was a time between 96 and 99 where Mike Mussina was one of those guys as well, too, when he was pitching for Baltimore. Mike Mussina, to me, was one of those guys that just gave you fits. That boy was absolutely electric too. But that's going to do it for us. I want to thank Chris. It's always a pleasure having you around the show. It's always good. Thank you for taking the time to come out. Bo, again, it's good to be back on the air after after a nice little 4.5 week layoff. It's good to have you back on the air. Good to hear your voice again, man. We'll be back next week, same time. We'll be back on our normal Wednesday or Thursday time slot. That will have yet to be decided, most likely Thursday, but same time frame. So until then, boys and girls, tune in next week. Bo, before we leave, we always cheers. What is your cheers for today?
Ooh, man, honestly, my cheers for today. Well, I'm drinking Four Roses Small Batch Bourbon.
Yeah, okay.
I recommend it to you guys. It's a very smooth, very good bourbon.
I'm not a bourbon drinker, but go ahead.
And this is going to surprise you because I've railed against the college football playoff. Railed against it. I thought that they got it wrong, and I don't like that. I just don't like the playoff system. But at the same time, we got a game coming up in the title game that we never would have gotten in the BCS. So I'm going to toast the college football playoff for finally at least getting a game I can at least somewhat acknowledge as a national championship game.
Fair enough. I'm actually going to be toasting, of course, the Seattle Seahawks. Predetermined victory of the Carolina Panthers. But you know what? Since it is the new year, Bo, I'm going to toast the Seattle Mariners to the eventual 2015 American League West champions, the Seattle Mariners, and the inevitable playoff success that will follow because we have Felix Hernandez and you don't. So there that is. thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll see you next week. Chris, thank you again, my friend. It's always good, man. It's always good, man.
I always love talking baseball with you guys anytime.
Absolutely. Bo, take us out.